A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost and you're listening to Consumer Issues here on Share Radio, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here with you from 9 until 1 every weekday, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online, join me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rich Browning here in the studio with me, Rachel Rickard-Strauss back at This Is Money HQ. They'll be talking about the top stories that they've been investigating this week, including as the dust settles on an extraordinary election before, during and, well, after. What will a Conservative majority mean for the pound in our pocket, including the hot topic, of course, of property as prices rise and stocks fall?
Even with the Help to Buy scheme, this is still not making it any easier for people to access the market.
Now, in theory, we at least should be a little clearer about the state of the UK economy and when interest rates are likely to rise. Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England, which of course has to keep shum during election periods, has delivered his quarterly inflation report.
The economy is growing, unemployment is falling, earnings growth is improving, and there is no evidence that household spending is being delayed.
We're reflecting on this, and we hear a lot here on Consumer Issues about budgeting as being the key to financial success. But how do you do it well? I mean, literally, how do you even begin? Well, as part of This Is How Money Works section on their website, Simon and the team have given you a blow-by-blow count. Also coming up, how bad driving habits can be costing us dear, how we can save on fuel, and who really is the better driver, men or women. And the end of the pensioner bond scheme is nigh. What impact have they had on a pretty unattractive wider market? Will we see them come back? And sticking with that theme, now these bonds offer rates of interest of 2.8% for a one-year bond, 4% for a three-year bond, far better than the return available elsewhere. But of course, you have to be over 65. So apart from rates, we're asking today, what gets better with age? Simon, starting with you, what gets better with age?
That's a good question. I think life gets better with age, basically.
Profound.
An all-encompassing answer. I don't think there's any reason why, as you get older, you can't do the things that you enjoyed when you were younger. You just need to try and make the time to do them. So I think life gets better with age.
Great answer. Rich?
I can't argue with that, really, can I? I think the great thing about getting older is this wisdom that some of us develop over the time. And this view of the world that you have where you don't have to worry about stuff, but you can learn from experience. If you learn from your experience, then the world's a better place for everybody, I think.
Totally agree with you. I think the same. I said me, which sounded a bit egotistical. But then I thought, well, if I don't get better with age, the only person I can blame is myself for not taking advantage of those lessons that we learn. And you don't care so much, do you, about what you look like, quite clearly.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rich Browning from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Coming up, just how is the UK economy doing, especially when the butt of all the work-shy jokes, France, are beating us in the productivity stakes. But first, they promise to cut inheritance tax, help to buy a home and help your money go further. But can the new Conservative majority government deliver on that? We'll take a look at what it means for our money. But before we do that, I have to get your reaction, please, gentlemen, to an extraordinary election.
So I must have... Right, I will admit something here. I actually said that I thought someone was going to win the election outright. Unfortunately, I didn't write about it or anything like that, so I can't prove it. But there are many people who I've had a conversation with. In fact, I won a pound off one of my colleagues at work, having said that. And he gave me the pound on Friday morning. It was to do with whether it's one of my US colleagues, and it was whether the pound, how it would do against the dollar. And he happily gave it to me. He said, yeah, you said it right. You said someone was going to win outright. But what I did say is that I didn't know who it was going to be. So I thought that the Conservatives would win outright, but I equally thought that maybe Labour could. Passion was running quite high, and there was potentially enough of the vote, the younger vote, the anti-Tory vote, that would be mobilised. But I think that the problem was the Labour campaign just made Labour supporters more angry. So in places where they had a safe majority, they increased their majority. But I think the Tory campaign appealed more to the sort of aspirational, don't meddle in my life, I just want to get ahead voter.
Also, Rich, do you think the SNP had a role to play in this, the fear of the SNP?
It was there was so much noise about the election, wasn't there, that it was really stoked up into a sort of black and white, this is right, this is wrong vote. And the Scottish people believed that that was absolutely the way to go, and they went for it. Personally, I wasn't surprised at all, and we probably ought to move the Houses of Parliament to Glasgow.
There is one comment I would add. It was about the week before, I did think actually that the Tories would win and there would be this majority. It's me and Lee were talking about this, and Lee had
Lee
said...
Lee Boyce, yeah.
Yeah, Lee Boyce, one of our journalists. He said that he'd been back to Southend, he'd seen some of his friends, tradesmen, electricians, plumbers kind of thing. And one of the people that he was talking to said, yeah, I'm going to vote Conservative because things are all right at the moment and I don't want Miliband coming in and stuffing things up. And I think that's where you win elections, is winning people with that kind of opinion. You don't win it by winning over the people who are obsessed with politics or the people who are always going to vote for you anyway. You win it with those swing voters and with all of Scotland ditching the other party.
Where do you think that it went so wrong for Labour?
The campaign wasn't great, to be honest. The statistical arguments that the Conservatives put forward were probably what swayed it for the swing voters, where the note that Cameron brought out, there's no money left. Well, you know, underlying some of these statistics were facts that were never really part of the Labour campaign, which was probably part of the problem, I think.
I think also there was a question of competence as well. And I'm not so sure that a lot of those swing voters saw the Labour leadership of Miliband and Ed Balls as particularly competent. And that's where the Tories won out, is because they've done a reasonable job with the economy over the last 5 years. They've not done the sparkling job that they maintain they've done. A lot of that would have just come about anyway, that growth, the return to growth. And they made some bad decisions, including some completely insane policies around housing, like Help to Buy and stuff like that. But, you know, they have been relatively competent, whereas Ed Balls was part of that Gordon Brown government that was seen as incompetent with the economy. And so I think people have just gone, well, we just trust these people more.
As a result of an extraordinary article by Dan Hodges in The Spectator, did Ed Miliband sacrifice Ed Balls, the Labour leader's court kept its fantasy alive right until the end. But strategically speaking, I'm talking here now about the pollsters getting it wrong and the impact that might have had on it. How did they get it so wrong, briefly?
Because no one ever admits that they're going to vote for the Conservatives.
Is it that simple? Come on, is it that simple?
You know what? There's a modern day test of this, right? Which I've discovered, which is your friends on Facebook. So my feed of my friends on Facebook was basically full of angry Labour supporters ranting about Tory this, Tory that. I don't remember at any point in the month running up to the election seeing anyone posting, well, I think they're all right and I'm going to vote for the Tories. And it is. There is an element of truth in that. And maybe there was just a lot of people who made their mind up on the day or a couple of days before.
I also don't think social media was a very good barometer of how people were going to necessarily vote or an outcome to the election. But what has added to all this drama is three leaders stood down, one then stood back up. Then we've got this bizarre situation of the Labour leadership contest, Chuckaruna withdrawing from it, saying he doesn't like the level of scrutiny. And then you've got the drama unfolding at UKIP. What is going on with the state of politics in this country at the moment? Because it can't be good, generally, that we have a lack of strength, I guess, in the other parties.
You know, that's one thing that the Labour Party have been good at over the past 5 years is you know, it's all very well to say after the event, oh, it was terrible, they were useless. Look at Ed Miliband and his crazy stone tablet of promises. And he can't even eat a bacon sandwich properly. And what's he talking about, freezing energy prices? And then that sends our bills up because they don't cut the prices because they think he's going to get in. Mm-hmm. But actually, they did provide a genuine opposition to the government. And I think actually if you look back to like the New Labour era, one of the big problems was that the Conservatives weren't a strong enough opposition. You need a strong opposition. But it's only a week after the election. It's not surprising that there's sort of turmoil. I reckon 6 months' time, you'll have a much stronger looking opposition to the Tories.
Well, let's take a little closer look at some of the promises that the Tories made and therefore will have to deliver on, because they're not part of a coalition now. So we're going to see lots of things come in. How's it going to impact the pound in our pockets? Simon?
Well, the parties were bribing people left, right and centre in the run-up to this election. There's no sort of greater measure of the fact that they thought this was going to be a tight election than the number of bribes that they were ushering out. So we've got some promises, which is they're going to raise the inheritance tax level, but this involves providing this new £175,000 per person transferable allowance that only relates to your home, which to me is a slightly insane policy. Actually, really, we need older people to be moving out of their large homes and freeing them up. This kind of just does more to sustain house prices being high. If they want to raise the inheritance tax level to £1 million, they should just raise the inheritance tax level to £1 million. I agree that it's a good idea to do that. I disagree with this policy. I don't think it's a particularly good one.
There is, simplicity is the ultimate thing we should all be striving for. But whenever tax gets involved, they have to complicate it, don't they? They're sort of unbudgeted. And how many people does inheritance tax, for example, affect? I know it's growing, but you just feel sometimes that maybe you just either leave it alone, or if you are going to change it, make it more simple.
I fundamentally agree with that. And I do think it's one of those things, it's weird, isn't it, where it doesn't affect that many people, but people really don't like it. And it's to do with the rise in house prices. And so they've tagged this into house prices, into the value of your home. But really, yeah, simplicity is the key measure of any tax. And this just is massively overcomplicated.
If you're looking at inheritance tax, let's move over to pensions. And the triple lock is going to stay in place. They did promise that that would stay in place. Lifetime allowance, though, will be cut, which you weren't a big fan of.
No, I think that's a bad idea. That's your lifetime allowance measures the size of your pension pot. Basically, it's what you put in and also the growth that you get. And it's gone from £1.8 million in 2010 to down to 1.25 now, and it's going down to £1 million from next year. And that sounds like an awful lot of money to people because they don't realise that there's a chance that they might get there through basically a lifetime of working and a lifetime of investment growth and the effects of inflation. So I don't think that's a good idea, but it does mean that these pension freedom moves are going to stay, where it's allowed people to save, spend or invest their pension as they choose, which there was some concern in the financial industry that that might be sort of reined back slightly if Labour got elected. I think the single best thing that the coalition government did for people's finances was to raise the personal allowance, the tax-free money that you can earn. Gone up to over £10,000 now, and I think that's risen from £7,000-something when they took over. That's genuinely helping the low-paid workers. And they've pledged that they're going to keep raising that as well, and it's going to go up to £12,500.
By 2020.
I think that's been a really good move, and it's good to see that.
Let's take a look at things like childcare. Rail fares could be frozen. Benefits could fall.
Childcare. Well, basically, they've pledged to double the amount of free weekly childcare for working parents with children aged 3 or 4 to 30 hours. Now, this is quite important, actually, because you get free childcare at the moment. You get 15 hours. But free childcare is a massive racket.
Explain for anyone who doesn't know.
So you only get it, you pro rata, right? So you can't just put your kid into nursery for 15 hours worth of childcare a week and just take the free stuff. Basically, if your child isn't in nursery full time, you get it pro rata down to the amount of days that you're there. For example, my daughters are at nursery. My daughter, who qualifies for this, is at nursery one day a week because my mum looks after her 2 days a week as well. My wife works 3 days. But that means that we only get a fifth of it. But then also, on top of that, you only get the childcare element free. They charge us some money for admin and meals while they're there. And basically, out of the cost of her day's nursery, which is about 75 quid, we're only saving about 30 quid. We're still paying a load of money. I could take my daughter out to breakfast and lunch for the amount of money we're being charged for food.
Cost of rail fares, as we've seen in the Financial Times, a report saying long routes have gone up 71% in a decade on average, even when you include RPI into that 30% rise. If only Lee Boyce was here.
You can see my house from the roof where I work. And it cost me £2,500 a year to get there on the train, and it's a terrible service.
But that doesn't include the tube, does it? That's only your
train. The tube's £900 a year for one stop.
But yeah, it's the same where my mum lives in Hertfordshire. It's a 25-minute journey into St Pancras, and if you wanted a season ticket for that, it's like £3,500, £4,000, which is just, it's preposterous. It's a huge sum of money.
This government pledge here is only a couple of hundred quid for, are they going to freeze some of the fares for a little bit? It's nothing, isn't it? It's a nice headline, but it strikes me that these train fares must be damaging the economy. If they were just cut in half,
So that's out of your post-tax income. So, you know, if you're to pay for your $3,500 train fare, you need to be earning quite a bit more money than that. And it's a drag on the economy because it's money that people can't be spending. I'd like to see all the commuter lines, certainly like within the London area, which is probably the biggest commuter hub in the country. It's almost certainly the biggest commuter hub in the country. I think they should be brought under Transport for London's control. So if you're coming in from St Albans or Southend or from, you know, Brighton even, basically, put it under Transport for London's control. Because if I get the tube to work, it takes 40 minutes and it costs me £2.70. If I get the train from Harpenden to St Pancras, it takes me 25 minutes and it costs me like 13, 14 quid.
So in sum, winners and losers of a Tory election win. Nearly 3 in 4 savers deciding to boost their investment portfolios in the wake of Conservatives' election win. Also, businesses as well. Investment in UK businesses popular again. Will this last? Who are the winners and losers?
Well, I guess probably older people with money are the winners. They're going to benefit from, well, they won't directly benefit from the inheritance tax thing because they will die in order to pass on their homes, and that's never considered a benefit. The home buyers, in the sense that they'll continue to get help to buy, but help to buy just drives up house prices, so I'm not sure that's really helping them. The lower paid will benefit from that raising of the tax-free personal allowance. But there are losers in terms of, you know, we're going to see more austerity potentially than we would have done with a Labour government. And we're also going to see the continuation of some of these cuts to things like housing benefit and stuff like that.
That voice you're hearing is editor Simon Lambert. Also in the studio with me, journalist Rich Browning from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of The Mail Online, live in the studio with me. Coming up, just a few hours left for older savers to get their hands on the hugely popular pensioner bonds. We'll be crossing live to This Is Money HQ for the latest on that. But first, we've just been talking about what a Conservative majority will mean for our personal finances, but what about the state of the economy in the UK more generally? Now, according to the Bank of England, Governor Mark Carney delivered his quarterly inflation report midweek. The economy will grow by less than expected over the next 3 years. Now, it's a key indicator of when we can expect interest rates to rise. The bank's base rate's been at that record low of 0.5% for more than 6 years. But Mark Carney reckons falling prices are temporary and inflation will pick up in the next few months.
The economy is growing, unemployment is falling, earnings growth is improving, and there is no evidence that household spending is being delayed.
So, Simon, I'm going to come to you first on this. Mark Carney, in that speech, he seemed pretty relaxed by all of this.
He always seems pretty relaxed. He's a pretty relaxed kind of guy. I actually quite like him. I think he's pretty good. I heard him on the radio yesterday morning explaining some stuff around productivity, and I thought he did quite a good job. I mean, to be honest, he hasn't really had a huge amount to do in terms of this, the fact that since he's been in charge, interest rates haven't moved. And basically all he's been doing is talking the game of they're not going to move. So the suggestion is they're not going to move for at least another year. The concern is these headwinds that have been identified, which is productivity. Our productivity is too low.
What is productivity? Well, why is it such a puzzle that everyone keeps talking about?
This is a good question. So what is productivity? Is it just because we're lazy? Is it Facebook? There's another suggestion that it might be email that's causing this problem. Unfortunately, the difficulty is that whilst we have a productivity problem, other nations are more productive and they do have email, Facebook and Twitter in other countries. So we can't just blame that.
France, but actually, case in point, as we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, but it's not actually the case. It's not the suggestion that we're just indolent, basically. The suggestion is that actually productivity falls because businesses don't invest. And businesses don't invest off the back of a financial crisis because they're concerned for the future. So how could you be more productive at work? Well, you could work harder, you could stop looking at Facebook, and you could turn your email off. Or your employer could invest in better equipment for you. You know, it might be that they just buy you a computer that works. Or it might be if you're working in a factory, they improve the machinery and things like that. And that improves the productivity. So you're producing more per hour than you would otherwise have done. And there's an argument that that not only means you produce more, but it means that you benefit because you'll get higher wages out the back of it. Mm. Theoretically, because basically companies in the economy are making more money. So this is why productivity has been identified as a problem. The other headwinds are austerity, so fiscal tightening, the government cutting back, and also this question of an in-out EU referendum, which is supposedly worrying businesses, and just the general state of the world where everyone's not completely convinced that we're out of the woods yet, probably quite rightly. So interest rates aren't going anywhere.
So then, yeah, it says about the will the Bank of England really scratch its seven-year itch and raise interest rates in 2016, which a lot of people are predicting. You've asked this question.
Yeah, so I'd sit on the fence to answer that, basically. I would say there's two scenarios that might play out. So I imagine there's a fairly strong chance we might get to a year's time and they're still talking about raising interest rates in a year's time, except that'll be 2017, because something bad will probably have happened between now and then. Alternatively, there is another scenario where one of those bad things that does happen, which is what I've written about here, is that actually inflation comes back much stronger than people think. In a year's time, you know, the oil price, the annual comparison between petrol prices and energy costs and all those other things is going to fall out. If we see a sudden return of inflation, it might be that they start talking about raising interest rates faster, not necessarily sooner, but just like faster and on a sharper curve. And there's a lot of big bets in the world at the moment on interest rates staying low for a very long time.
I mean, you say that right at the end. One day a rate rise will come, whenever that date may be, and it pays to be prepared. Remember, it's not the exact date that matters, but how quickly or slowly rates rise after that. So I guess that's the issue. Be prepared. Also, as we heard Mark Carney say there, the Governor of the Bank of England, the employment outlook remaining strong, UK unemployment falling to a seven-year low, but pay rates continue to disappoint. Your views on this, and also he made comments that have been picked up in lots of the papers about the cheap foreign labour force, the impact of immigration.
Well, he also said yesterday that that was actually outstripped by the effect of old people.
Older workers, indeed.
Yeah, and people wanting to work more hours. So actually, if you combined the rise in the number of people who are over the age of 65, or sort of older workers working, and also the number of people wanting to work more hours, that was something like a 500, added the equivalent of like 500,000 extra people working, I think. Whereas he said that immigration was, net immigration was about 50,000 a year.
Let's focus on some of the figures as well. Unemployment falling to a seven-year low. Do we know the sorts of jobs we're talking about here?
Well, unemployment's, we're doing really well. Our labour market's doing really well. Unemployment is very low. But the question, there's questions now over the quality of those jobs,
which returns us back to productivity again.
Yeah, around these sort of zero-hour contracts and things like that. And are people doing the kind of jobs that they want to be doing, and are they doing them at a high enough level? I mean, it's definitely there's a definite product of the financial crisis that there's an awful lot of graduates doing jobs that they're massively overqualified for.
Rich, your views?
I think the this thing about the pay is something that we shouldn't overlook, really, because people aren't being paid enough. And if everybody was paid more, then we'd have more tax revenue coming in and it would be better for everybody. I think some of these low-grade jobs, you know, that don't pay the what we call the living wage, are a problem. And it's all very well to sort of gloss over that, but it will come back to haunt us, I think.
Basic pay expected to grow by just 1.8% in the coming year, down from 2% in the previous quarter. Let's stick very briefly with Mark Carney urging for any referendum to be as quick as necessary. Since the Conservative won the election, a lot of talk has been about Brexit and a referendum.
Rich was talking to me about this on the way over here, actually. He says he's absolutely fascinated by this subject.
Are you, Rich?
I consider myself to be European over and above any other nationality, really. I've worked in France several times. I used to go shopping in France at the weekend when the exchange rate was so amazing that it was actually cheaper to drive.
Goodness
to
me,
Calais.
Like food shopping or something?
Just a sort of weekly shop.
Oh, wow, that's extraordinary.
I had a loyalty card at the Dunkirk supermarket.
With the rise of online shopping, can you now pay a Frenchman to come round to your house with the shopping?
But, yeah, I think, you know, in a global economy, Europe is massively important. We sort of look at it as some strange foreign thing, but the figures for the value of the exports that we send over there, I think it's about the same as exports to the rest of the world. You know, the estimates for the benefits of Europe for our economy is about £80 billion a year or something. You can't just laugh that off.
Look, I think that my personal view is that we're better off in the EU than we are out of the EU. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the EU needs to be much more about a free trade area and about breaking down the barriers of doing business and working in other countries and other things like that. And I don't think that, you know, a lot of people are a big fan of the sort of federalist European state. The Eurozone is a mess. The Euro is a mess. Basically, there's a lot of stuff that's not going very well there. And I actually think that's just as much of a concern for many people in our other European neighbouring countries as it is for us in Britain.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome if you've just joined us. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rich Browning from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website, and Money section of the Mail Online, live in the studio with me right now. And now the National Savings and Investments deployed extra staff today to deal with a possible last-minute surge from older savers rushing to get their hands on the hugely popular pensioner bonds before they're withdrawn from sale at midnight. The rates of interest of 2.8% for 1-year bond, 4% for a 3-year bond, far better than the return available on savings accounts in the wider market. But of course, you have to be over 65. So let's cross live now to the This Is Money HQ to join Rachel Rickard-Strauss. A very warm welcome to you, Rachel.
Good morning, Georgie.
Just remind us about these bonds and why they're just so attractive.
They're just such winners in the market at the moment. I mean, where else are you going to find 4% on a bond?
A very good question, Rachel. Where are you going to find 4%?
Well, that's it. Basically, you don't. Once you've got them, there's no refunds and you're locked in either for 1 year or three. But they are really worthy of consideration if you are over 65.
How much money's gone in?
We don't know. Osborne won't tell us yet. He initially set aside $10 billion to be invested in them, but there was such high demand and people getting a little bit panicky trying to get in, that he changed it from a cost total to a deadline instead. So by March, the $10 billion had already been snapped up. I think about 825,000 pensioners it was who had already taken advantage of them. That was March. Into May, it'll be a lot more than $10 billion now.
Indeed. More generally, Rachel, what impact do you think that this has had on the market, the savings markets more generally?
It's just extraordinary what's happened, sort of indicative of just what proportion of savings are held by people over 65, that when these bonds were launched in February, £320 million was put into investment funds. But just a couple months before that, in December, it was £1.7 billion. So it's just a huge amount of money is not going into these other funds. And exactly the same thing has happened to current and savings accounts. There's been massive withdrawals from both of those as well, simply because the rates that people are receiving in those other places are incomparable to what you can receive with these pensioner bonds.
Do you think we're likely to see them again with that in mind?
I'm pretty cynical, so I'm going to say absolutely not. That it's perhaps no coincidence that these bonds were launched just a few months before a general election, when the older vote is very important to the Conservative Party.
So you're suggesting in 5 years' time we might see something similar, is that right?
Well, I mean, certainly it wouldn't happen before then, but in 5 years' time, hopefully, as you're saying before, interest rates will have started to rise. There won't be the same kind of starvation of rates for savers, so perhaps it won't be such an issue for people. And certainly, you know, by the time we might be eligible, you and I, for pensioner bonds, not a chance. So really.
But if people are likely to miss the boat with these bonds, or like you and I, Rachel, just a tinsy-wincy bit too young to apply, what other bonds are worth investing in? The risks attached to it?
Well, see, this is the sad thing. I'm looking at the best buy tables that we have on thisismoney.co.uk, which we update with all the best rates as they come up. So at the moment, as I said, that the best one-year pensioner bond pays out 2.8%. The best one-year bond that isn't one of these on the high street is 1.52%. A three-year deal, the best you can get is from Paragon Bank at the moment. That's 2.5%.
Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money HQ, thank you so much for joining us. Well, from pensioner bonds to property. New figures show that house prices were up last month, but the number of properties available were down to its lowest level in 6 years. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors said the decrease was broadly down to uncertainty over the general election. Earlier, I spoke to Simon Rubinson, the chief economist at the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, about the findings.
One can identify certain issues, whether it is related to additional potential taxes is an obvious one that might impact on the way people behave. But I think there's also just a general sort of inevitability about sort of uncertainty around election t- time weighing on whether people want to take on commitments. And, you know, it may be as simple as that, you know, they don't know whether that has any bearing on the outlook for interest rates, for example. Now, we know that Bank of England is responsible for setting interest rates rather than the government directly, but there are sort of, you know, I think there's a level of uncertainty, confusion about how that plays out. So I think it's just as elections breed lead to uncertainty about policy, and that has an impact on people, because just from a point of view of taking on a big commitment, you always tend to want to know a little bit about the outlook before doing so. My concern is that actually the downward trend in new stock coming to the market actually predates election uncertainty. And if we don't see more stock coming up for sale, then even a modest increase in prices will push prices even higher. And you know, that's a real challenge for a lot of first-time buyers. Even with the Help to Buy scheme, this is still not making it any easier for people to access the market.
Now, Simon Rich, we heard there the impact of the election, but this is a problem that Simon Rubinson, who's from the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, thinks has been going on for a lot longer. Indeed, his head of policy there at RICS said that the affordability and availability of homes in the UK was now a national emergency, all political parties pledging to increase home building. What are your thoughts on this? Are we likely to see this happening at the amount that we need?
I think it would be very difficult to build the number of homes that they're talking about every year. I mean, they're talking about building 300,000 homes a year. I think at the moment we build about 160,000, 170,000, something like that. It'd be very difficult to build all those homes, especially seeing as a lot of the homes that need to be built are basically social housing, council houses, affordable homes. It's not necessarily the developers that are the big issue. So I'm not so sure that we will see all of those homes being built. The one thing I would say about this thing is that I do think there is something in here about there just being a shortage of homes for sale. People just aren't moving.
My house is up for sale at the moment.
You're doing your bit, Rich. Well done.
But then he's got to find somewhere else to live, hasn't he?
That's the problem.
Completely futile. There is nothing to move to at all.
And that drives up prices. And most people buy a house that's more expensive than the one they're living in now. And because of the way that, you know, prices rise, basically, the more expensive ones tend to get more expensive faster, and the gap gets bigger. And you can, like, look at the gap, and the gap is £100,000. And it's like, how do you find £100,000?
So what does the government need to do? What needs to happen then? What can happen?
I wonder whether we've actually reached peak house price. So, I mean, there's people being sent to view our house, the first-time buyers, and there is no way that a first-time buyer can afford £500,000. Not in the real world. We've had no offers because I don't think people can afford the prices of houses now.
But it's a very different situation. So 1966, the Conservative Manifesto, I think, went on about getting houses up, keeping prices down. If you own a home, you certainly don't want that.
I'll tell you something about something that happened in 1966 that puts that in perspective. My grandmother moved into a brand new council house in Wellingborough City with my mum and her daughter and my mum's sister. They were the first people to ever live there. It was a brand new house.
It was the last time that 300,000 homes were built.
And you don't get that scenario nowadays very often, do you?
But you do. Your article does suggest a further rise in house prices could be on the way. So, Rich, your prediction of a perhaps peaking may not be
It's logical, isn't it, that if there isn't enough supply, then the price goes up. But if nobody can actually afford to buy these things, then...
There does come a point where you just can't physically borrow any more money. And there is a limited number of people who can raise the deposits needed when you've got, say a house is costing you £250,000. It's a lot of money to raise the deposit on that. Maybe there does come a point where you reach peak house price. Peak house.
We shall see.
We've already reached peak house, haven't we? We're not building enough of them.
Well, that's in 66 by the sound of it.
That sounds like a new ITV period drama, peak house. The mansion tax fears rather impacted on the housing market. So much so it wiped a staggering £140,000 off prime London homes. This is also on This Is Money. Tell us a bit more about this.
Well, basically this is about the London has two property markets, essentially. So nationally, you've got two property markets. You've got the rest of the country and London. And then within London, you've kind of got two property markets as well. There's the prime central London property market, you know, the really swanky zone one bits where you've got to be a millionaire to live there kind of thing. Or you've lived there for years and you're being shunted out by high house prices. And then there's the other bit around it where the normal people live. And prime central London, you know, this was the bit that bounced straight back off the financial crisis much faster than anywhere else. You know, prices were going up by huge amounts. You were seeing these flats being built with, like, astonishingly high prices being put on them. Well, apparently this market has gone slammed into reverse, and it has slammed into reverse, and prices are down 8%, it was suggested, since the start of the year. So that wiped £140,000 off prime London homes in just 3 months, with swanky apartments the hardest hit. And these figures come from an investment company called London Central Portfolio. They run a funds that basically invest in these prime apartments. I know Naomi Heaton, who runs the place, and she knows her stuff. She's been working in the London property market for a long time. And this doesn't necessarily affect them so much, because actually what they're doing is they're buying apartments that need some work to them doing to improve the value, and then they rent them out, and then they go into these collective funds that you can invest in. But where I think it's really hitting is the new build apartments, where at the moment there's actually a massive supply of them coming onto the market. There's loads of them being built, way more than there probably is demand for them. And the problem with a swanky new build apartment is you can't go in there and improve the value. You can't go in there, do some work and raise the value on it. You're basically paying top whack for something that's brand new, shiny and gleaming. So you're right at the most expensive end of the market. And being right at the most expensive end of the market is a dangerous place to be, because that's where prices tend to fall the hardest.
Heart bleeds, I'm sure. I just want to touch on one story. Rich, you've got green fingers, not weed. What's this all about?
Oh, it's planting something in your garden that really doesn't belong in your garden or in the country at all.
But can have this a real problem with mortgage lenders, right?
It's, Japanese knotweed. It's a massively invasive plant that, for some reason, is still legal to grow. I had a similar problem to this in my back garden, not with Japanese knotweed, but with Russian vine that grows about a foot a day, and it just completely takes over. Now, it took years of knocking a wall down to get rid of it in the end, but the Japanese knotweed is so invasive, so difficult to get rid of, that if it is found in a survey of a house you want to buy, you can't get a mortgage.
Right, Barclays, Nationwide Building Society, Santander, Leeds Building Society, Skipton, Yorkshire Bank and Clydesdale Bank all say that if you have found knotweed, well, get rid of it or they'll have a problem with it.
And you have to pay a specialist to get rid of it, thousands of pounds. Funnily enough, though, I met up with a friend for a drink a couple of weeks back who was telling me about this, and he's buying a flat that's got Japanese knotweed in the garden. Basically, he's managed to get a load of money off the value of the flat because basically nobody would buy it. So he's got about 10% off the purchase price of a flat in London, which is pretty much unheard of. But he's got to get these specialists to come round, and it's going to cost, you know, a lot of money, but he's saving more money than that. But apparently this was a big problem around the Olympic area. And so actually, because he's buying in East London, there's loads of firms around the Olympic area who specialise in getting rid of knotweed, because they got rid of a load of knotweed for the Olympics. But yeah, the mortgage company were willing to lend him the money, but they wanted to know absolutely certainly that he was signing up to this thing.
Now, from knotweed, I have no good link to this, so we're just going to talk about cars, really. You've been answering readers' emails investigating if turning off the car engine in traffic can really save fuel. So firstly, how did you research this, Rich? Did you get out in the car and just give it a go, or was this a bit more scientific?
I don't drive very often, but it sounds like a good deal to me. You know, you can save a bit of environment if your engine cuts out when you're not using it.
And you get a lot of these stop-start cars now. This is a big thing for green cars, the stop-start technology. When you stop at the lights, the car turns itself off, and then when you want to go again, you just push the accelerator, it starts up and off you go. We had a hire car that did this, and it was a little bit disconcerting to begin with. My wife said to me, "You just stalled the car." I was like, no, it turned itself off. I was like, "Watch." And then put my foot down and off it went. Although, basically, I then tried to show it to her again and then did actually stall the car in slow-moving traffic. But the thing about them is like, there was always this sort of urban legend when I was younger that basically said, if you turned the car off and turned it back on again, you used more petrol. Not necessarily true, but it does depend on how long you're stopped for. So if you're going to be stopped for only a very short period of time, it's not worth you actually turning your car off and turning it back on again. And also, these stop-start cars are designed to do that, whereas your car isn't. And you can put an extra heavy strain on the battery and other components that isn't meant to be there by constantly, because cars are not designed to constantly be started.
So if you know it'll be stationary for a while, worth it. Stopping the engine for very short periods, not. But you talking there about stalling your car with your wife leads us rather on to a recent study that officially declares that women are better drivers than men. By the way, female drivers outscored men, not only in in-car tests, but also when they were secretly watched at Hyde Park Corner in London. Women scored 23.6 points out of a possible 30. Men only managed 19.8. Your thoughts?
Is that because there's more male minicab drivers driving around Hyde Park Corner in London, like it's the Monaco Grand Prix?
I also wonder if it was women that were doing the scoring as well.
I don't mind admitting I'm a terrible driver.
All right, fair enough.
It's so boring. You know, your sort of mind wanders and anything can happen.
See, investigations, though, don't stop there. We're talking about how to save on fuel, women drivers. Also, your team's been looking into what causes our nation's traffic jams. Here's a couple of clues. I think that's cows. Is that cows? And unsupervised children, apparently, officially responsible for some of the nation's traffic jams. A freedom of information request to get that information. It's what privacy campaigners have been fighting for years. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, I will admit here that we didn't actually put in the freedom of information request. It was done by the Institute of Advanced Motorists. Those are people who are very good drivers. Now, they've basically found that, actually, only one in seven lane closures are actually caused by roadworks, which is, you know, you might not realise, and that the rest of them are down to, a lot of them are down to, four out of ten are down to vehicle breakdowns. And then there's some other things that cause problems, as you said, like unsupervised children, thoughtless pedestrians, Japanese knotweed just growing in the middle of the road.
Everybody else but me.
Everybody else but me. If you drive any distance in this country, then you do encounter an awful lot of roadworks. But what you encounter is an awful lot of roadworks where nobody appears to be doing any work. Some years ago, I drove with a friend of mine from London up to a place on the other side of the M6 from the Lake District where we were going to go snowboarding. There is a place up there with a ski lift, and we drove up there on Friday night to go snowboarding for the weekend. There was a couple of years back, we had loads of snow. Between London and where we came off the M6 at Penrith, we encountered countless bits of roadworks. And only one of them did I see someone doing some work. And do you know what they were doing? They were putting cones out.
We've gone full circle, haven't we, to the productivity problem. Before I let you go, guys, I do have to say, on your website, I've always wondered, whenever we talk about the key to financial success, everyone talks about budgeting, but how you literally do it. Charles Dickens, Mr. Micawber, saying annual income £20, annual expenditure £19.6, result is happiness. Annual income £20, annual expenditure £20.6, result misery. So why can budgeting be so hard to do, and where can we go to find your blow-by-blow account?
Well, this is part of our This Is How Money Works section that we've created, which is sort of like basic guides to help people out. And you can find it at thisismoney.co.uk/howmoneyworks. And it's aimed at basically, you know, trying to get people to do a bit of budgeting, because I don't think there's many people in this world who wouldn't benefit from doing some budgeting. And some of it's around if you're in struggling and you want to get out of debt, but a lot of it's also around just like everyday life and bringing those costs down to make sure that you're spending as little as possible on the things that are your essentials, so you've got more to spend on yourself or save or invest. And also, we've got at the moment, we've also on that page got the opportunity to download a guide from that L&G have produced called The Rough Guide to Family Finance. And it's free, basically. You can go on, download it to your computer or to your iPad or your phone, and you can read through it. And it's actually really good practical stuff about how to help you with your everyday finances. And I mean, Rich is the author of our 50 Ways to Save Money. He is a legend in this kind of stuff.
So, is that also on the website, Rich?
It's, yeah. 5 million readers can't be wrong.
Well, 5 million readers can't be wrong, and you can't be wrong either.
Oh, should we put some money on that?
So is that in your tip, guys?
That's the tip. Put some money on it.
The trouble with budgeting is people worry about it too much and beat themselves up about it. And it's actually quite fun to just go through and see what you're spending and go, oh, right, I probably don't need to spend that on that.
That's fun, to find out what I'm spending money on. I think it's traumatic.
Well, no, that's the problem, you see. It's the wrong way to think about it.
You can set yourself a bit of a challenge in some parts of it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I remember having a conversation a couple of years back with my wife about we seem to be spending an inordinate amount of money on our supermarket shop. And I said to her, do you reckon we could basically just spend £70 a week on our food shopping? And she was like, yeah, I reckon we could do that. So we tried to stick under the 70 quid. And it does become a little bit of a challenge of like, can you do that? But actually, once you get into the habit of it, you find that you're spending less money. And we spend much less money on that like weekly shop now than we did before, even with me randomly going into shops on a Friday or Saturday night, bottle of wine, couple of bottles of beer, I'm hungry, buy this, buy that.
Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rich Browning from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much for joining us.